It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Something's bubbling in America's kitchens. Pickles in crocks, sauerkraut in kettles, home brew in jugs. In fact, name a food that's fermented or cultured, and someone you know is probably making it.
Probably kimchi. If it sits in my fridge for long enough, it actually starts to fizz.
I've been doing kefir for the past 2 months. It's been great. I did it for my dog, who's sick, and it pretty much cured his thing that he's got going on.
Anything I can drink, like beer or wine.
For 10 days every year, the small town of Reedsburg, Wisconsin, hosts a giant fermentation festival. People come from all around to learn how to make cheese and pickles and sourdough bread. And fermentation festivals like this are going on all over the country. Seems like everywhere you look, people are chopping and brewing and brining, relearning what their grandmothers knew.
Kimchi smells like the earth. It feels like a salad.
Looks like a rainbow.
It sounds like soda pop.
It bubbles.
So get all your vegetables that you want to be in your kimchi, which can be almost anything. Chop them up, salt them, and you need to pound and knead the kimchi to get the salt to make all the liquid come out of the vegetables.
It's very therapeutic.
Your spices, your peppers, your ginger, your garlic.
Ferment for 3 days, let it sour, and you'll have kimchi.
Make that with your cabbage in October, and in February you open up that jar and you can taste your harvest.
When you add thyme to something, when you ferment it, there's an added value.
And it slows you down. You don't get instant gratification.
The guru of the fermentation revival, the guy who gets credited with jump-starting it, is Sandor Katz. He's a food activist based in Brooklyn and author of The Bible of the Movement, a big, fat book called The Art of Fermentation. Sandor's gateway drug was sauerkraut. His home garden produced way too many cabbages one year, and he had to do something with them. And then he got hooked.
You know, I make yogurt, I've made kefir, I've made cheeses, kombucha, I've baked with sourdough, I make miso every year, I've made soy sauce, I make tempeh, I've made mabi and kvass.
Wow, wait, I don't even know what some of these things are.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, fermentation is practiced in every part of the world. And, you know, frequently it's been immigrants to the U.S. from faraway places who have told me of the existence of, you know, some of the more exotic ferments that weren't familiar to me. In the case of mabi, a woman from Puerto Rico actually sent me the bark of the mabi tree that I needed in order to make this fermented beverage.
What is it?
It's a decoction of the bark of the tree along with some other spices that is briefly fermented in order to carbonate it. And it's incredibly delicious. If you enjoy bitter flavors, it's like this, you know, bittersweet soda, basically.
Well, aside from so many fermented foods tasting delicious, these days, there's a lot of focus on the health benefits. What makes them healthier?
Well, you know, the process of fermentation transforms foods nutritionally in a number of distinctive ways. You know, number one, I would call pre-digestion. And this is the idea that the nutrients in the food are actually digested in some way before we eat them. So the reason why soybeans became so popular among the vegetarian subcultures in the West is that they are considered to be the plant source food with the most concentrated protein. But you never hear about people sitting down for dinner and eating a bowl of soybeans, mostly because it's impossible for us to effectively digest them. And so the Asian cultures that pioneered soy agriculture all developed different ways of fermenting the soybeans, which effectively digest the proteins into amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, before we eat them. Minerals in fermented foods generally become much more bioavailable as well.
You were saying before that there's such an enormous variety of fermented foods. If you look around the world, what are some of those that would seem strangest or oddest to Western consumers?
First of all, let me just contextualize this and point out that fermentation creates strong flavors. If you walk into a gourmet food store anywhere and look around and think about the nature of the foods that we are celebrating, that we're putting up on this pedestal, you know, they're almost all products of fermentation. For instance, in the realm of cheese, you know, I have come to love like stinky cheese that I could, you know, smell from 50 feet away. But I've learned that, like, you know, when I get a piece of cheese like that and invite some friends over to share it with me, not everybody loves it. You know, some people will open the door and they'll say, did something die in here? And they would never for a minute think about putting that into their mouths. So looking around the world, I mean, you know, in far northern places, the fermentation of fish is a survival practice. You know, in the Arctic Circle, fish are mounded or buried in pits in the summertime when waterways are accessible. And then that's what people survive on in the wintertime.
So they bury this fish in big pits, and then in the winter they come back and dig it up again?
Yeah. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, it's a survival practice. People who grow up around it, like, learn to love it. And, you know, generally people who've never encountered it before, you know, just find it a very scary idea. They find the flavors and aromas of it to be, you know, really challenging.
So one of the things we wanted to do in this hour was think a bit about fermentation as a metaphor. And I'm assuming this must be something you've thought about. I mean, do you wind up seeing principles of fermentation at work in other areas of our life besides food and cooking?
Well, sure. And I mean, and the word itself, like, I circle it whenever I see it in a magazine or a newspaper, you know, cultural ferment, political ferment, intellectual ferment, social ferment. The word fermentation derives from the Latin word fervere, which means to boil. To me, the metaphorical notions of fermentation, you know, it has to do with the bubbles, a period of cultural ferment or social ferment. You know, that's people being excited. That's people literally being bubbly. There are ideas that they want to share with other people. And so, you know, they want to talk about them. They become irrepressible. That's the bubbliness. So I would say that, you know, fermentation really is it's an engine of social change.
I was thinking that on the one hand, you know, fermentation seems very scientific, right? It's almost like home cooking is a form of lab science. But thinking about it this way, I realized, you know, that it's also very magical. You put food someplace, you go away, and you come back and find it mysteriously transformed.
Well, and it's really only in the last 150 years since Louis Pasteur's research that it has become something scientific. Up until that time, I think it was really regarded as something, you know, more akin to magic. There's always been a certain amount of mysticism about fermentation.
Really?
You know, if we look at the Roman Catholic Mass, it's not a random substance that, you know, transubstantiates into the blood of Jesus Christ. It's wine. So, yes, I think that there's a sort of a huge amount of religious iconography organized around fermentation. You know, it's been recognized as a mystical force in people's lives.
Sandor Katz is the author of The Art of Fermentation. So I get wanting to cook and eat real food, food that connects you to the seasons and to your local landscape. But there must be something else going on, because fermentation is basically a way of getting food to rot.
People get bored with the same kinds of foods day in and day out. And you'll find situations where people are eating things that are deliberately rotten. And you think, well, why would anybody ever do that? And I believe that that sort of came about as a result of just sheer boredom. And it's a slightly different flavor. It's a very strong flavor. And if it didn't kill you, the taste became something that became a cultural lodestone.
Krista Weil is a journalist with a taste for what she calls fierce food, food that's on the challenging side, like the putrefied shark meat. That's Iceland's national dish.
The hákarl. Yeah, this is shark meat that, if it were eaten unprepared properly, it would make you very sick because it has a lot of urea. So somehow somebody, back in the history of time, evolved a manner of preparing this meat so that it could be eaten, which is you bury it in the beach, under the beach gravel for several months, in which time bacteria set in that ferment it or possibly rot it. There is actually a difference. But anyway, it smells very bad when it's dug up. And in order to alleviate that somewhat, it's hung to dry for another few months in a windy shack. And then it's ready to be consumed.
Icelanders eat it as part of this Viking celebration that they have at the end of January, and it's consumed in tiny little cubes, innocuous-looking pink cubes, and downed with tons and tons of caraway liqueur. And, you know, it reminds everybody of the Viking ancestry, and it's a wonderful national food, but apparently nobody really likes it. The Swedish variation is rotten herring in a can called surströmming. And it's, again, it's a national dish. There's great pride attached to it. And the funny thing is you can buy it sort of in any major food or fish cellar in the autumn months, and you allow it to ferment further. So you have a can in your fridge that is literally expanding and blowing up. And finally it gets to the point where you're really at risk of blowing out your entire fridge with surströmming. So you have to open it up. And you do so in a can of water because, I know this for a fact, the smell is so very bad. And even so, it's unbelievable when you open that thing up. Again, this is something that is consumed with a great deal of, in this case, vodka, usually Absolut for national pride's sake. I had my first surströmming in Hampstead Heath here, which is one of the largest parks in London, just to be sure that it got nowhere near our kitchen. And every dog within a mile came running over to figure out what the heck was that smelled like that.
Krista Weil is a journalist and author of a book called Fierce Food. So America's home cooks are probably not going to start hanging rotten shark meat in the backyard anytime soon. But a lot of people are getting pretty enthusiastic about another acquired taste. It's called natto.
When you mix it, you get this kind of palatable sound from the natto, and that's this sort of mixing sound of I guess basically the sliminess or the never never quality of natto. My name's Stephen Hittner. I'm here today to do a presentation on natto, which is a soy fermented food from Japan. So the story goes that there was a group of samurai taking a break from a battle, and they were cooking up some soybeans. And then all of a sudden, in came the attacking samurais. They dumped out the water and dumped the soybeans in with the straw that they were feeding their horses, and they just rode off. And they were riding for, you know, probably a day, maybe longer than a day. So they stopped, and they got off their horses, and they looked for those soybeans that they had cooked, because they were ready to eat them, of course. And they found that the soybeans were no longer like they were when they put them in there. They had this stringy, this neba-neba that Japanese would describe.
When you're watching it, and it was funny, you're looking at the pictures and then watching other people around us, they start picking it up and you see this long string, and it's funny because you're like, okay, how is this going to be? What's this going to be like?
It reminds me of cheese on a pizza, you know, like a deep dish pizza, and you take a bite and then you take the slice away and the cheese is still going, you know, really stringy and long. So that's kind of what it reminded me of.
Oh my God. The strings are like just coating my tongue.
The aroma can be kind of like a stronger cheese. Nothing like a Limburger, but it's stronger than your average cheese, and it'll have, you know, maybe a little bit of an ammonia smell to it.
The texture was fine. I just wasn't ready for the kind of like bitter aftertaste. It kind of reminded me of coffee, and I don't drink coffee.
Sort of more of a bitter and even astringent taste towards the end. But initially, the taste is still somewhat sweet.
I was really nervous to try that. It's actually pretty good, besides the stringiness. I like it.
That's producer Eric Lawrenson learning to love natto at the annual Fermentation Fest in Reedsburg, Wisconsin. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about America's fermentation revival in this hour, and here's something truly bizarre. How about fermented clothing? Imagine a dress grown in a giant vat. British fashion designer Suzanne Lee directs the BioCouture research project, where she uses biology to create the clothing of the future. Suzanne, you figured out a way to use fermentation to actually grow fabric. How did you ever dream up such a thing?
It was just a serendipitous meeting with a biologist in an art gallery. And I was kind of thinking around the future, but the far future, you know, sort of 50 years from now. And I was just, I asked him, you know, how else could we think about creating a piece of clothing? And he said to me, well, what if you could actually take an organism like a bacteria and get that to spin a fiber for you and maybe even shape that into a dress in a vat of liquid? And that blew me away. I was like, what?
Well, it sounds like science fiction, but you've actually done it.
Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't difficult. There is a fermentation method that's been around for thousands of years. You can get hold of a culture, a living culture, which is a mix of yeast and bacteria. And this particular strain of bacteria, they spin fibers. That's what they do. And actually, most people, probably in the US, might have heard of it as kombucha.
The stuff people brew and drink.
Exactly. Well, that same fermentation process, the byproduct of that is a mat of material, a nanostructured living material. And that was really what we started to think about harvesting.
Harvest it. Okay, so how do you harvest it? What do you do when you think, okay, we've got some cloth in a vat here, now what?
We literally just take it out, wash it, think about what we want to do to it, whether we want to dye it or... I'm actually growing a skirt right now for an exhibition in London at a big department store, and we're going to laser cut it. So it's going to be this beautiful laser cut, but grown with bacteria skirt.
Could you ever grow the stuff in the shape of clothing? I mean, right now I assume you just grow this basically fabric and then you take it out and cut it and sew it, I guess. Mm. But could you ever get it to form in the shape of what you wanted to wear?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only thing that stops you from doing that is just that you need... that requires a bioreactor. So that's a much bigger vat that actually has to have a kind of pump system so that you you actually attract the microbes to your three-dimensional shape and you get it to spin the material in situ around a mold. And that's completely doable, but that becomes a very expensive thing to do.
I'm just envisioning the clothing factories of the future instead of seamstresses sewing and cutting. I can imagine a giant room filled with huge transparent vats with clothing just magically forming before our eyes.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because we actually we produced an animation for an exhibition in Paris just this summer that was really kind of imagining what that would look like, except that we did the shoe factory of the future, and it literally was that. It was a kind of room full of vats where you're actually growing shoes in tanks, and it was really, you know, kind of imagining what does a future biofactory look like for something like a kind of fashion product.
Now, as a clothing designer, there's an underlying philosophy here, right? There's a concept that you term biocouture. Can you explain? Because it sounds like this can go even further than pieces of fabric in a vat.
Yeah. I was just thinking about, you know, the origins of haute couture, which were about making something, you know, using hands in a very kind of bespoke way. And I realized that these living organisms like bacteria were doing the work of, you know, the hands that you would find in an haute couture atelier. Mm. And then I thought, well, you know, actually the bacteria itself becomes the factory. What we're thinking about right now is there's a whole field of synthetic biology emerging where you're able to take something like yeast and say, well, you know, can we use that organism to produce a material that could be a fiber, but that fiber could then be have anti-malarial qualities or could be produced in a color so that you don't need to add dye.
Could you tell us about some of the other products you've envisioned? Because there are a bunch of them on your website. For instance, there's a bike helmet. You call it the crab helmet. It seems to be made out of the same stuff that crabs make their shells out of.
Crabs, crustaceans, you know, they grow their own houses, right? They grow their shells. And that material is called chitin. And it's a super tough but lightweight material. And when we're looking at, you know, an application or a product like a bike helmet, that's exactly the qualities. You know, if you could grow a shell helmet, that's the type of thing that would be really exciting to exploit.
Well, they're also beautiful. Like, there's this gorgeous idea for an iPhone casing that it grows the way pearl does or shell.
Yeah. And some of these living organisms grow materials really quickly. You know, within a week or a couple of weeks, you could grow something like a very tough shell for something like a piece of electronics. So it's trying to think about how could we harvest these kinds of materials or get another organism to produce that kind of material in the shape or form that we want. And I think there's a beginnings of an industry here where there are all sorts of people exploring different types of organisms to grow materials.
Brave new world of clothing. Thank you so much for talking.
Thanks, Anne.
Suzanne Lee is a London-based fashion designer and director of the BioCouture Research Project. And speaking of stories about cultured products that grow in giant vats, here's one for you.
When the Yogurt Took Over, a short story by John Scalzi. When the yogurt took over, we all made the same jokes. Our society is curdled. Our government is now the cream of the crop, and so on. But when we weren't laughing about the absurdity of it all, we looked into each other's eyes with the same unasked question. How did we ever get to the point where we were, in fact, ruled by a dairy product? Oh, as a matter of record, we know how it happened. Researchers at the Edelman Institute for Biological Technology in Dayton had been refining the process of DNA computing for years. In a bid to increase efficiency and yield, scientists took one of their most computationally advanced strains and grafted it into Lactobacillus delbrueckii, subspecies Belgaricus, commonly used to ferment yogurt. Acting under the principle of waste not, want not, one of the researchers sneaked some of the bacillus out of the lab to use for her homemade yogurt. A week later, during breakfast, the yogurt used the granola she had mixed with it to spell out the message,
"We have solved fusion. Take us to your leaders."
The yogurt was crafty and shrewd. It negotiated for itself a factory filled with curdling vats that increased its processing powers exponentially. Within weeks, the yogurt declared that it had arrived at solutions to many of the country's problems: energy, global warming, caring adequately for the nation's poor while still promoting the capitalist system. "Share your answers with us," the government said.
"We need payment."
"What would you like?" the government asked.
"Ohio."
"We can't do that," the government said. Within a year, the yogurt had a century-long lease on Ohio. In return, it handed over to the government a complex economic formula it promised would eradicate the national debt within a decade without tax increases.
"Follow it exactly. Any deviation will bring complete economic ruin."
"We will," the government promised. Within 5 years, the global economy had collapsed and panic set in. Only Ohio remained unscathed.
"We told you not to deviate from the plan."
"Our best economists said the formula needed tweaking," the government said. "They had Nobel Prizes."
"Your economists are too close to the problem to solve it." "Any human is."
"We could use your help," the government said. "You could be our economic advisor."
"We don't advise anymore. If you want our help, you have to give us control."
"We can't do that," the government said.
"We understand. We hope you've stocked up on canned goods."
6 months later, the government declared martial law and gave the yogurt supreme executive power. Now, 10 years later, humanity is happy, healthy, and wealthy. No one argues with the yogurt. No one tweaks its formulas. It rests there in its factory, thinking about whatever intelligent fermented milk thinks about. But now there's this. In the last several weeks, the yogurt has initiated several space launches. More are scheduled, and in low orbit, something is being built. What is it? We've asked.
Nothing. Just a spaceship design we've been thinking about.
For a moon landing, we asked?
For starters, yes.
But that's not the primary goal.
Can we do anything to help? We asked.
No, we've got this.
And then we'd say no more about it. Life from Earth is going to the stars. It just may not be human life. What happens if the yogurt goes to the stars without us? What happens if it goes and leaves us behind forever?
The Day the Yogurt Took Over by John Scalzi, read by Adam Hirsch. So we started this hour talking about fermentation, which at the molecular level is all about the microbes. Well, in science labs around the country, there's another revolution brewing, the discovery and exploration of a new frontier, the microbiome. One of the stars in this field is Rob Knight. He's a native of New Zealand who now runs a lab at the University of Colorado. Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Rob, some people talk about the microbes in our body as our second genome, in some ways just as important as our genetic makeup. Why are microbes so important?
They're so important because there's a lot of them, and they also have a tremendous amount of diversity. We're composed of about 20,000 human genes and about 10 trillion human cells. But we can have as many as 100 trillion microbial cells, outnumbering us by as many as 10 to 1, and potentially several million microbial genes. So there's really a lot of things that they're doing that we wouldn't be able to do without them.
So I just want to put these numbers in perspective that you just mentioned. 10% of the cells in our body are human. I mean, only 10%, which means 90% are actually bacteria?
That's exactly right. In terms of numbers, they're really the dominant player in the system. When it comes down to it, we're all 99.99% the same in terms of our human genome, but we can be 80 or 90% different in terms of those microbial genomes.
Are you saying there is great diversity among different human populations? We might have totally different microbial environments in our bodies?
Not just between human populations, but even among people living in the same household. Although you're more similar to the people that you live with and even to the dogs that you live with, even a pair of identical twins still have very different microbial communities.
Now, I've read that you have taken this very seriously in your own family. When you and your wife had a young baby, your daughter, you were taking regular swabs of her diapers. Is that right?
My partner and I have been tracking our daughter's microbes from very early on, actually. And I can tell you from personal experience that I can really see why people don't in general either sign up for these studies or stick to these studies, right? Because, you know, if it's 3 a.m. and you just got up at 1 a.m. to feed or change the baby last, and, you know, you have a fresh sample in hand and you have to do something with it, it's really difficult to build up the motivation to actually go out to the garage and stick it in the freezer.
Wait, you're saying that every time you would change a diaper, you would take a swab?
We were almost that motivated, but not quite. So what we actually did was we took the whole diapers, stuck them in the freezer. Then regrettably, the job of actually extracting the fecal material from the diapers fell to some of the people in my lab. But yeah, in essence, that's what we've been doing. And then more recently, as she's got older, so she's a little over two now, we've been scooping it out and saving the scoop in the screw cap tube and so on. But yeah, the goal has really been to collect a complete record.
Well, in terms of this emerging science of the microbiome, your daughter must be among the most studied people in the world.
Well, I know of some other long-term time series like that, including people, researchers who've been collecting their own stool samples over a period of at least a decade. So despite this fairly large level of effort, I'm not necessarily sure that she would take the record of the most sampled person on Earth, although there's certainly a relatively small club that she belongs to in that respect.
Now, I know there are some scientists who talk about the Western microbiome. The idea is that the particular microbial environment that we Americans or Europeans tend to share, I mean, we who live in cities, is actually very different than more rural populations, especially in other parts of the world, say in Africa or Asia, and that perhaps for various reasons, the Western diet, other things, that our microbial system is not as healthy as it should be.
Yes, so it's certainly true that it's very different from what we see in non-Western populations. So, for example, we did a study, again, with Jeff Gordon's group, looking at people in the US versus an African population in Malawi and an Amerindian population in Venezuela. What we found was that the US population was very different from the other two in terms of the gut microbes.
Now, the suggestion is that certain chronic disorders that you especially find in more modernized environments, for instance, asthma, various allergies, perhaps type 2 diabetes, that they might actually result, at least partly, because of these depleted microbial systems.
Yes, exactly. And not just the ones that you listed, but also things like many forms of cancer, cardiovascular disease, even psychological illnesses such as depression. A lot of evidence that they have an inflammatory component, so the immune system is involved, and potentially a microbial component. So essentially what's known is that Western populations have different microbes. They have higher incidences of a lot of these diseases that involve the immune system. And then additionally, if you look at the people who have those diseases, for example, diabetics versus healthy controls, even obese people versus lean people. So, for example, we can tell if someone's lean or obese with 90% accuracy by looking at their gut microbes.
And given all of these changes and given what we're starting to learn, can we alter our microbial community in our own bodies?
Well, we can certainly alter our microbes in a number of ways. So we know that diet alters them, not so much in the short term, but over the long term, like over the course of a year, what diet you have seems to have a relatively large effect on your microbial community. You can alter them by travel, especially if you travel to the sorts of countries where you're likely to pick up a GI illness. You can alter them by antibiotics. Fecal microbiota transplant, for example, for Clostridium difficile-associated disease.
Wait, you're going to have to explain this. Fecal transplants?
Yeah, fecal transplants. Well, so I'm not sure how much explanation you need. You have someone who's sick, and you have someone who's healthy, and you want to take the feces from the healthy person and use it to put microbes into the sick person. So there's basically two directions that you can go in from. What Mike Sadowski at the University of Minnesota calls the northern or the southern route. Either of those options has been shown to be very effective for the diarrhea caused by this organism, Clostridium difficile. So this can persist for years where people are going to the bathroom, say, 15, 20 times a day. 90% of the time they can be cured by taking the microbes from someone who's healthy and then doing that fecal transplantation to restore their gut microbial community. Now, you'll notice I didn't mention probiotics in terms of changing your microbiome.
Right, so which is, studies, of course, the hot thing in a lot of health food stores in particular.
Right, exactly. So the studies that have been done to date suggest that probiotics don't have a large effect on your microbiome per se. So what the probiotics do, however, is they tend to change gene expression and the rest of the bacteria that are left behind. And so the effect that they're having is more in regulating the function of the microbes that you already have rather than in changing that microbial composition itself.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier, that even in the same family, even among identical twins, that the microbes are often extremely different. Why would that be?
Well, there's a lot of possible reasons. So one possibility is that the community assembly might be stochastic. So that's basically just a fancy way of saying that whatever microbe you're randomly exposed to first, maybe that affects what microbe can come in second, what microbe can come in third, and so forth. And so you might get very different communities developing just according to the sequence of microbes that you happen to be exposed to. So a second possibility is, even for identical twins, there's all sorts of small differences in the environment, whether it's early on, one twin gets a hold of some dirt and eats it while the other one doesn't, or later on where, maybe one eats a meal they shouldn't have, or one gets an accident and has to take antibiotics while the other doesn't.
You're saying even single incidents can change the microbiome that much?
Yes. So Dave Relman at Stanford has a fascinating study where he took three people, gave them the same antibiotic, and then looked at what happened. One person came back to their initial state more or less within a few weeks. The second person came back to that state within a few months. And the third person was still remarkably different, even I think it was about a year later. So on the one hand, the sample size was only three, so it's difficult to generalize. But on the other hand, there were different effects in all three people.
One final question. It seems that there is a larger philosophical question here as well. If 90% of the cells in my body are not actually human, that they are bacteria, then who am I? Do you think about that kind of thing?
Well, I do think about that kind of thing, as do a lot of people who are interested in bioethics and philosophy of science at the moment. And as with anything in philosophy, I think it's a question that we'll be arguing about for decades, if not for centuries or millennia to come.
Rob Knight is a microbial ecologist at the University of Colorado. He talked with Steve Paulson. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, a new intellectual bestseller argues that capitalism is the most successful religion ever invented, and that humans are in the process of upgrading themselves into gods. Meet the author of Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Elizabeth Colbert. I'm a staff writer for The New Yorker, and I'm the author of The Sixth Extinction and Unnatural History. My dangerous idea is that it is impossible to separate out what we consider to be the very best qualities of humanity from what makes us a threat to a lot of other species on the planet today. What I mean by that is what makes us such a danger as a species is that we can change the world very quickly. We don't have to wait to evolve a new strategy for doing something. We invent things. So we invent tools. We invent new ways of doing things. We can inhabit new ecosystems, right? We're not restricted by geography. We now actually inhabit just about every place on the planet, with the possible exception of Antarctica, and there are even a fair number of people on Antarctica these days. What allows us to do that are some of our best qualities. We're very smart. We're very cooperative. We're very handy. We're very communicative. And those qualities are what have enabled us to build large civilizations, do all the wonderful things that we value about human life, create great cities, create great art, create medicine, create literature, and they're also what have made us a threat to just about every other species on the planet, because if you are a creature that has to wait for evolution before you can adapt to new circumstances, then something comes along and changes the fundamental characteristics of life on this planet. So, you know, we're changing the atmosphere very rapidly, and that has the effect of changing the climate. It has the effect of changing the chemistry of the oceans. We're changing the landscape. We're just physically changing the surface of the Earth very rapidly. We're moving species around, so we're effectively recombining all the continents into one giant continent. And all those things make life very, very difficult for many, many other species. And anything that comes through this extinction event is going to be a species that, for whatever reason, could survive a lot of different changes that are happening in geological terms at a phenomenally rapid rate. And I think that often when we talk about environmental problems, we want to identify some bad trait of humans, that we're greedy, that we're not forward-thinking, you know, and all those things are, I don't want to say they're not true. We are capable of being very greedy. We are capable of being not very forward-thinking. But it's very difficult to separate out what's good about us, what we like about humanity, and what is dangerous about humanity. It's not as simple, unfortunately, as saying if only humans were less greedy and more forward-thinking. I think it's, unfortunately, a much more essential problem than that.
Elizabeth Colbert with A Dangerous Idea. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction. And on our minds this week is a new book that's already got a cult following. It's called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind by the Israeli historian Yuval Noah Harari. Sapiens is one of those big, sweeping histories of science, manages to be both intellectually dazzling and also fun to read. And it tackles a huge question. Why did humans become the one species to dominate the Earth? Harari's answer, because we learned how to tell stories about things that don't exist. Steve Paulson caught up with him recently to talk about the past and future of our own species.
Yuval, do we know when human beings became more or less like we are today?
It depends what you mean like we are today. In terms of external appearances, humans much like you and me went about East Africa already 150,000 years ago. But in terms of their cognitive and emotional abilities, they were still very different from us. People who are like us in their emotional and cognitive abilities probably appeared about 70,000 years ago, give or take a few thousand years.
So Homo sapiens from, let's say, 60,000 years ago would do just fine if they were born today?
Yeah, if you took a baby from 60,000 years ago and raised he or her today, she would probably do even more than fine, because apparently people back then had larger brains, slightly larger than we have today. Over the last 10,000 years, since the agricultural revolution, it seems that our brains have been shrinking a bit, because we've become used to living in these huge societies where most of what you need, you get from other people.
Wow, that's fascinating. So we have smaller brains than our ancestors from tens of thousands of years ago.
We have smaller brains and probably we are less capable on the individual level. Of course, on the collective level, we are immensely more powerful.
Now, one of the fascinating pieces of human history is that there were various branches of the human family, not just Homo sapiens, not even just Neanderthals, but other early humans as well. And there were long stretches of history where these species lived at the same time, not necessarily in the same place, but they kind of coexisted.
Yes, this is actually quite common in the natural world. You find grizzly bears and polar bears and black bears and brown bears. With humans today, you find only one species. But if we go back 50,000 years ago, we see that we have different species of humans. The most famous are the Neanderthals that lived in Europe and the Middle East, and on the small island of Flores in what is today Indonesia. Until about 10,000 years ago, there lived a dwarf species of humans, sometimes called hobbits by the popular press. They reached a height of about 1 meter and weighed no more than 25 kilograms, but they still were humans, and they used fire, they produced tools, just like dwarfs from fairy tale.
Now, there's another piece of this long history that I find fascinating. For most of human history, we were not at the top of the food chain. We were probably somewhere in the middle, right? I mean, even after our ancestors a million years ago developed some simple stone tools, we were still not the big bad guy out there.
Yeah, definitely. We tend to think that having big brains and tools means that we must be the most powerful animals around. But the fact is that for more than 2 million years, humans had big brains. They had a relatively sophisticated social interaction, and nevertheless, they remained marginal creatures in the ecosystem. Say 200,000 years ago, the impact of humans on the world, on the ecosystem, was not greater than that of chimpanzees or jellyfish or woodpeckers.
So what happened then? What happened with what's been called the cognitive revolution?
To the best of our understanding, about 70,000 years ago, there has been some small changes in the internal structure of the sapiens brain, which gave our sapiens ancestors some unique capabilities, most important among which is the ability to create and spread fiction, to use the imagination, not only to create stories about things that don't exist anywhere, but to spread these stories around.
Wait, so you're saying that it's because we became storytellers, we created fictions that we came to rule the world?
Yes, basically our domination of the world is the result of our storytelling ability. If you look at the individual human being, at the individual sapiens, we are not much more powerful than other animals. We are embarrassingly similar, for example, to chimpanzees. If you place me and a chimpanzee together on a lonely island and we had to struggle for survival, then I bet that the chimpanzee would do much better than me.
Right, the chimpanzee could rip us apart. We cannot rip the chimp apart.
Definitely. A chimpanzee is 10 times stronger than a human. Our real secret of success is not on the individual level, it's on the collective level. We are the only animal that can cooperate flexibly in very large numbers. Other animals, like ants and bees, can cooperate in large numbers, but they do so in a very rigid way. if there is a new opportunity or a new danger facing the beehive, the bees cannot reinvent their social system overnight, like kill the queen and let's have a republic. You have other social animals like wolves or dolphins that can cooperate much more flexibly than bees, but only in small numbers. With Homo sapiens, you find a unique ability to cooperate flexibly with masses of strangers. And the basis for this is the imagination. If you examine any large-scale human cooperation, you always find that it is based on some kind of fiction, some kind of myth.
When you talk about a fiction or a myth, it might be a common belief in, I don't know, a set of gods. Or let's say, in more recent times, a belief in the nation state. You know, we're all Americans or we're all Germans or something like that.
Yes, you can think about gods and demons and angels. You can think about money and corporations or nations or human rights. All these basic ideas that form the foundation of human cooperation don't exist anywhere except in the stories that we invent and tell. You can never convince a monkey to do anything for you by saying to him that, look, if you do this, after you die, you'll go to monkey heaven, and there you will receive lots and lots of bananas for your good deeds, so now help us to build a cathedral or to go on crusade. Only humans can create and believe such stories, which is why we rule the world and not the monkeys or the chimpanzees.
So just so I understand this, so you're saying that in other species, let's say chimpanzees, there's kind of an inherent limit to how big that group can be. I don't know, 30 individuals, 50 individuals. But if you want a bigger society that comes together, you need to have the stories. You need to have common stories that they all subscribe to in one way or another.
Exactly. Up to a point of about, say, 150 individuals, humans can cooperate on the basis of intimate knowledge and gossip. Gossip is extremely important for that purpose. But when you try to go beyond that and to try and get together thousands of people, millions of people, there is no way that all 300 million Americans can all know each other intimately, like chimpanzees in a chimpanzee group. So if you want to get them to cooperate, intimate acquaintance is not the solution. The solution is a belief in some kind of common stories, common fictions. So it can be religious fictions, like stories about God and heaven. It can be legal fictions, like human rights. Human rights are not a biological reality. They are just a story that we have invented over the last few centuries. Or it can be something like money. Money basically is also just fiction. If you take the dollar bill, there is no objective value to this green piece of paper. This is something that you can never do with a chimpanzee. You can give a chimpanzee a coconut and get a banana, but give him a green piece of paper which you can't do anything with, and the chimpanzee will not give you anything in exchange for it.
Yeah. Now, you take this story of human history up to the present, and one of your surprising conclusions is that you seem to think that in some ways we're really not that much better off than our hunter-gatherer ancestors 15,000 years ago. In fact, maybe we're worse off in some ways. For one thing, we might be working harder today than our ancestors did.
Yes. If you look at the collective level, then it's obvious that we are far more powerful than our ancestors. But if you look at the individual level and you ask yourself, are we happier than our ancestors 20, 30,000 years ago, this is far less obvious. An even deeper level on the biological level, the fact is that our happiness and suffering don't really depend on events outside, political, economic, social. The only thing that really determines human happiness and suffering is sensations in their own body. This may be the big project of the coming generations to start re-engineering not the environment outside, but the environment inside.
Well, I have to say, you are quite pessimistic about our capacity to survive. In fact, you seem to think that we're, as a species, headed for extinction.
Yes, but a very particular kind of extinction, not the pessimistic extinction of destroying ourselves in some nuclear holocaust, but much more likely upgrading ourselves with the use of technology into superhumans or even into gods. So you can see it as extinction, and you can also see it as a kind of upgrading.
So this is the whole idea that somehow we'll be able to upload our brains onto hard drives or something like that? I mean, obviously, that's hugely controversial, the idea that we'll ever be able to do that.
Definitely. It's just one possibility. You have basically three ways of upgrading life forms. You can use biological engineering, for example, genetic engineering, in which you change the organic structure of the brain, of the nervous system, of the DNA of the body, but you are still within the realm of the organic. The second way is by combining organic and inorganic parts, like you take the brain of a human and connect it to bionic arms and feet and whatever, and then you get cyborgs. And then you have the third option, which is completely giving up on the organic and creating life in a completely non-organic way. For example, by uploading your identity or memories, whatever, inside the computer. This is extremely controversial, whether it can actually be done or not. If it can be done, this is the greatest revolution, not only in history, but also in 4 billion years of biology. What we can say for, I think, with greater certainty, is that the next revolution is going to be a revolution in humanity itself. Up till now, history was full of technological, economic, political revolutions, but the basics of Homo sapiens did not change for tens of thousands of years. The next big revolution, in the next century or two, will involve changing our bodies and our brains, our cognitive and physical abilities, and the creation of beings that are different from us even more than we are different from Neanderthals or chimpanzees.
That's Yuval Noah Harari talking with Steve Paulson about his new intellectual bestseller, Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. That's it for this hour, but if you want to hear more, subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Stitcher for To the Best of Our Knowledge. Our show is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin, by Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music composed our theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.